Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm really delighted to be in conversation today with the new president of the University at Albany, Dr. Javedan Rodriguez. Dr. Rodriguez was appointed by the SUNY Board of Trustees as the 20th president in June 2017, took office in September 2017 after more than 25 years as a leader in higher education. Before coming to UAlbany, Dr. Rodriguez was the founding provost and executive vice president for academic affairs at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, UTRGV. Rodriguez was instrumental in creating UTRGV, a new public research university, and building the university's new medical school from the ground up. Rodriguez had previously served as interim president and provost and vice president for academic affairs at the University of Texas Pan American, which merged with the University of Texas at Brownsville to become UTRGV. Prior to his leadership positions in Texas, Rodriguez spent 7 years at the University of Delaware as deputy provost, vice provost for academic affairs and international programs, and professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. He also directed the University of Delaware's acclaimed Disaster Research Center, the world's first research center devoted to the studying the complex social problems that result from natural and technological disasters and other community-scale crises. He's also held faculty and administrative positions at the University of Puerto Rico and served as director of the Minority Affairs Program for the American Sociological Association. A respected scholar, he studies the socioeconomic impacts of disasters and the economic well-being of minority populations in the United States and Puerto Rico. Rodriguez received a B.S. in psychology from the University of Maryland, an M.A. in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and a Ph.D. in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a town I know pretty well. He and his wife, Rosie Lopez, have 3 grown children. Welcome, University of Albany President Dr. Javedan Rodriguez.
Thank you so much. It's really a great pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the invitation, and I appreciate the conversation we're about to have about the University at Albany and the great future that's in the making for this great institution of higher education.
So you've spent a lot of time. I want to go back to the beginning, but you've spent a lot of time as a provost. Tell us what a provost does.
A provost is, it all depends on what period of time you're referring to, right? Yeah. If you're referring to medieval times, the provost was the jail keeper. And so his role was to keep inmates secure and safe. But in modern times, the provost is the chief academic officer. And so the provost with his or her team manages the academic affairs of the institution. Depending on what institution you are, at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, my role was a bit more complex than that because it was not only about the academic program, but was the research enterprise focusing on the School of Medicine, information technology, and student success.
When you're the provost, you're in the hot seat. You have to decide on promotions. You have to decide on tenure.
That's right.
That choice, the hot seat, right?
That's right. And, you know, typically speaking at most universities, the provost is sort of the second person in the line of the hierarchy after the president. You know, typically the president, although not exclusively, focuses on the external matters with the university funding, raising, et cetera, where the provost focuses on managing the internal affairs of the university, but promotion and tenure, post-tenure reviews, and evaluations of faculty are a critical component of the work that the provost does.
Do you think a president of a university ever says to the provost, hey, look, I know that we depend on you, but we're going to overrule you on this one. Has it ever happened?
Well, I think it happens once in a while. I think it depends on the relationship between the president and the provost. It depends on the type of work that the provost does. And so the president really has a high and should have a high degree of confidence in terms of the work that the provost does. My former boss, the president of the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, when he used to introduce me, he always used to say, and this is the person with the most difficult job on campus, the provost, right? So if the president understands the challenges and the complexities of the provost, and there's a good relationship, I think that rather than overturning, there's this coordination and communication, right? And understanding that the provost is doing the best thing in the best interest of the institution.
I don't think it happens often.
I do not.
But I've seen situations in which it has happened.
Oh, yes. And I have too.
So let me proceed way back to the beginning. You were born where?
I was born in Puerto Rico in this town called Arecibo. If you ever watched the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, Arecibo has the largest radar, or now the second largest radar telescope in the world.
Really?
And so that's where I was born, in the city of Arecibo.
And what did your folks do?
I grew up primarily in a single mother household, and my mother recently, about several years ago actually, just completed her GED in high school. And so she worked in many jobs, including being a taxi driver in New York City.
Really?
Yes, she did.
That's got to be scary at some point.
Well, I think she, you know, as a single mom, right, that I grew up with, she was responsible for raising three kids, my two sisters and I. I'm the oldest of the three. And she worked incredibly hard to ensure that we continued to move forward and instilled in us the great value of education, of working hard, no matter the difficulties and the challenges that you confronted, that you needed to continue to move forward in order to be successful. So
how'd she do it? In other words, what were the techniques? This is very important, I think. Mm-hmm. What were the techniques that she used for instilling that the importance of education in her kids?
I think, you know, one of the major things was she focused on doing her work, and she worked incredibly hard, as I said before, in order to support and maintain three kids growing up. We moved from Puerto Rico when I was 5 years old, and we moved and lived in the Bronx for about 10 years, so from 5 to 15 years old, and she worked there, and she's worked basically all her life into fairly recently. But, you know, her focus was we need to move forward. We need to improve our social and economic conditions. And one of the ways in which we do this is through higher education. And so knowing the work and the sacrifice that my mother had gone through, right, given our poor upbringing, it highlighted the critical importance of the role of education and how education is a transformative agent that can really move you from one level in terms of the socioeconomic ladder to another. So instilling in us the hard work, that ethic of hard work, of perseverance, of don't give up no matter what happens, no matter what difficult conditions you confront, it is imperative that you continue to look at the future and think about this future being bright and exciting. No matter the current circumstances, things will get better.
Now, here you are running a place that I taught for many, many years. We would ask you this. How important is your arrival in terms of spreading that message to people who otherwise at a state university might be disenfranchised?
You know, I think it's a critically important message. And I think that as the 20th president of the university at Albany, I play a key leadership role for the university and for the community and for the region as well in highlighting the importance of working with students of all backgrounds and all colors and all beliefs to ensure that they are successful in our society, to provide access, to ensure that we continue to educate the next generations of folks that will continue to make important social, economic, political contributions to our state, our region, and the country, and the world, quite literally. And, you know, one of the things that UAlbany is known for nationwide is for its upward economic mobility, I mean, of our students, right? And so you see that this education is transformational, not only for the individual student, right, but for their families, for the community, and beyond as well. So this is a critical role that we all play in helping our students be successful.
So we're talking to Dr. Javidan Rodriguez, 20th president of SUNY at Albany. Okay, so for 1 year, I taught at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice down in New York, and that was a point at which there was access. Access became incredibly important, but then there broke out a huge fight, access versus standards. Mm-hmm. You want to let people in, you want to get as many people in as you possibly can and push them up. But on the other hand, there was terrible recrimination that the standards of the university had fallen. That's always going to be a tension, right?
It is, but I think that the focus here should always be providing access, but ensuring that we deliver a quality and excellent education and that we focus on the success of our students, right? And that is so critically important.
But no free ticket. In other words, you got to pass.
You have to pass. What we have to do always is promote excellence in everything that we do. If you reduce the rigor, if you reduce the standard, you are having an adverse impact on our students, on the university, on the community and on the agencies that employ these students. And so you're having negative consequences all the way around. So you provide access, but you focus on success and you focus on providing an excellent education. So you graduate, engage global citizens that will continue to transform our societies. Now, that's the value of education.
Now, I'm sure your people told you this was not going to be the easiest of interviews because I've been known as somewhat contentious, which I don't really think is fair. But I did want to ask you this. So now you have access. You want to make sure that everybody is adhering to standards. But into all of this comes the idea that the students should rate the professors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I first started out at college, we had a guy named, I think his name was D for Dollard, because he gave a lot of D's. I don't think when somebody gives a lot of negative grades, although little people write me and say, well, I'm my favorite professor and all the rest of this stuff. But what happens? Isn't there a certain amount of professors who say, I'm not going to start failing people if it's going to mean I'm not going to get tenure because I'm doing this?
So, you know, it's quite interesting because as you talk to students across the institution and in other institutions as well, who are the faculty that they talk a lot about and who are the faculty that they learned a lot from?
Yeah, right.
The faculty that challenged them, the faculty that engaged them, the faculty that they sat down and had in-depth conversations about the subject at hand for that particular student. So by challenging our students and by engaging our students, we're really transforming our students, right? And so I don't think that our focus, my focus as an administrator, my focus as a faculty and as a researcher should not be on what evaluation the student is going to provide me. My focus is on providing the very best, highest quality education to our students and making sure that when my students leave my classroom, they are well prepared for next steps, right? And I think if you do that and you focus on that, you know, you're going to get great reviews from your students.
Well, I couldn't help but notice that when you were going through all of the things that a good professor does, the one thing you left out is they challenged me, they taught me, they inculcated me. You didn't say they failed me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there room for a professor failing a student now?
And there is, right? I mean, you know, I think that the professor's responsibility is to ensure that students obtain the necessary knowledge, necessary background and experience in their classrooms, and they satisfy certain criteria that you set up front for these students, and right? So making clear what the expectations are, and if you don't meet those expectations, you're not going to get the grade, right? I mean, this is part of the process. And, you know, as a faculty member, I know a few students that I actually failed in some of my courses who later turned out to be some of the very best students I had and are now faculty members because they've done incredibly well. It served to really transform the student. I think we have to have a process in which students know how they're going to be evaluated, what the criteria are, what the standards are, and what you need to do in order to get a C, a B, or an A. And if you don't, well, you know, these are the consequences. But I think there's got to be this exchange. I think, and I'm passionate about the fact that student success begins in the classroom, right? Student success begins in the classroom. And I think that's critical for all of us to really focus us on and understand because you as a faculty member, I as a faculty member, have such a dramatic and significant impact on the lives of our students. I can think in terms of my career and how I got here, right? And I can tell you, you know, when I was an undergraduate student, it was Pat Donovan. That was the faculty member that really transformed me and transformed my life in terms of pursuing a graduate and a PhD.
Tell me about him.
You know, Pat Donovan, I did my undergraduate degree with the University of Maryland, but this was a global campus. They had an RAF Alconbury, Royal Air Force Base in Alconbury, because I joined the Air Force given we could no longer afford me going to college. I decided to join the Air Force and I finished my degree with the University of Maryland. And Pat Donovan was one of these faculty members in sociology who had traveled the world. He sort of still looked, you know, in the 1980s like a 1960s, long hair, you know, very engaging, etc. But he was the one that instilled in me the importance of going on and getting a master's and a PhD. And he said, you know, you're you're going to be incredibly successful, right? But you have to do X, Y, and Z. And he mentored me along the way. And thanks to him, I decided to go on to grad school. So I engaged in my master's degree. William Velez was my mentor at that level. And I worked with William Velez, a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And he instilled in me the importance of getting a PhD and become a faculty member. You know, and it's a full circle. Several years ago, I published a book called Latinos and Latinas in the United States, Changing the Face of America. And my mentor 20, 25 years ago was now an author in my book, right? And so those experiences and those mentors are the ones that help me get to where I am. And so we as faculty members have this transformational power that sometimes we don't think about, but that really transformed the lives of students. And so I remember the Pat Donovans in my life. I remember the William Velases in my life and many other faculty who helped me along the way. They did not minimize standards. They did not reduce the rigor. Actually, they challenged me to the highest levels, but they were there to support me and mentor me and ensure that I was successful.
Now my mentor happened to be Puerto Rican, Dr. Elena Padilla, who wrote a classic book called Up from Puerto Rico, very early in the game, and was tougher than nails. Mm-hmm. How tough does a mentor have to be? In other words, she would say, Shartok, you're going to take this sentence out of the dissertation. And I was expected to fight and defend it. And then she would let me have it.
And I don't think that there's such thing as a degree of toughness, right? But there's a degree of how do I challenge my students to learn? You know, I remember the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, when I took a theory course in sociology, every time I went to my faculty member in that course, and I asked them a question about a specific theoretical issue in sociology, he would hand me a book, and he says, the answer to your question is in this book. And then I would go the following week and I would say, you know, I have a question about this issue or this particular area. He would give me another book and he would say, the answer to your question is in that book. Find it, right? And so I think that instilled in me a sense of inquiry, a sense of we have to investigate, we have to engage in studying the areas that we want to focus on. And the faculty members are there to guide us, right? It would have been easy for him to say, well, this is the answer to your question. But he chose not to do so. He chose to challenge me and say, by the end of the semester, I had a stack of books on my desk, right, of all these books that I wanted to read. And I said, well, you know, do I want to ask him the next question? But I did, and he did that with every student. And I think, you know, we remember him because he was a great and engaging faculty, and we learned a tremendous deal from him in terms of our areas of excellence.
I did a lot of work on the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and I spent a lot of time there. It had a tremendous history department. I mean, it was known as one of the great history departments in the country. But I'm wondering about your PhD itself. Mm-hmm. I found if there was a traumatic event in my life, it was writing my PhD. My PhD, I remember handing it to my dissertation advisor, Dr. Padilla. It was about 1,000 pages long, and she said, the good news is you have a dissertation. The bad news is it's twice as long as it's going to be when we're done with it. Most people who work on PhDs will tell you that this was the most strenuous point in their life. Was it for you?
You know, it was. It was difficult and it was complicated. I got a PhD in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but my focus was on demography.
Demography as in?
And population changes, migration, mortality, fertility, things of that nature. And the Center for Demography and the demography program at the University of Wisconsin was at that time, and still is, one of the top three demography programs in the world, actually. So very engaging and very demanding. And, you know, when I first chose my dissertation topic, well, I thought I had chosen my dissertation topic, you know, my advisor said, this is really a great project, great ideas, you'll get great publications out of this. It's going to take you about 10 or 20 years to do. And so I don't think that should be your dissertation topic. And so
this is what every single person goes through.
Exactly.
I knew somebody who wanted to write a dissertation on why parents hit their kids. Well, that was very nice. If you think that would have taken you 20 years, and I spent a lot of time trying to convince this individual that that is not what they wanted to write on. They wanted a specific, you know, data-driven, contained area. And I said, and then write a book afterwards, which is what we've all heard about why people hit their kids.
That's right. So, you know, so my advisor, mentor Jim Sweet at that time channeled me into a more concrete project, which has actually turned out to be an area that I focused on for the past 30 years, which is focusing on socioeconomic mobility and economic well-being of Puerto Ricans on the the island and Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans on the mainland. So comparative analysis of the socioeconomic well-being, economic well-being, mobility, and migration, which actually in a couple of months we'll have a book out with two colleagues of mine at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley focusing exactly on this issue. So that'll be coming out soon.
So let's see if we can make some news here. You, of course, are an outstanding scholar. You know as much about Puerto Rico as anyone does. You have just watched a terrible tragedy overtake Puerto Rico. Do you have any observations about what you're seeing?
Well, you know, as you already know, my other area of expertise focuses on the socioeconomic impacts of disasters. And so when I went to the University of Delaware, I went to lead the Disaster Research Center, as you said in your introductory remarks, the oldest and the leading disaster research center in the world, actually. One of the things that we did there, we had quick response teams. So major disaster happened, and then you would deploy a team of faculty and doctoral students to that particular area. So I took teams to India and Sri Lanka following the Indian Ocean tsunami. I took a variety of teams throughout the Gulf Coast following Hurricane Katrina, and we spent some time throughout the Midwest following hurricanes, etc. And we also took a team to Honduras following Hurricane Mitch. And so this is work that I've done, and I also have another editor book that's coming out in a couple of months focusing on the socioeconomic impacts of disasters as well. And so I've looked very closely not only at the situation in Puerto Rico. Being from Puerto Rico myself, I have a lot of family and friends still in Puerto Rico. My wife has a lot of family and friends in Puerto Rico. So I've seen this from a personal perspective and also from a professional perspective as a researcher. And when you combine, right, when you think about Hurricane Harvey, and then you think about Hurricane Irma, and then Hurricane Maria, and then you think about the earthquakes in Mexico that took place, and then you think about the massacre that took place in Las Vegas. You know, you really think about the impacts that all these events have on our daily lives, how we prepare and how we respond for these types of events.
So response is important, but motivation is also, if that's the right word, is also important. We have a president of the United States, sorry to do this to you, but we have a president of the United States who says he's not sure about climate change. We know that the scientific community is united on this question. And we have a president who is basically saying, let's put some more coal into the atmosphere. And then we see what's happened to Puerto Rico. One and one makes two, yes?
Well, that is a critical factor. And as you may know, right, we have some of our scientists at the University at Albany just received a major National Science Foundation grant, $5 million, to study climatic variability and climatic changes for the past 1,000 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so that will also provide concrete evidence about how the climate has changed and the impact, right? A socioeconomic impact on the environment and how that impacts what we see in our day-to-day living. Because you can very well see, for example, in going back to the case of Puerto Rico, right? And the impact that this event has had, one of the most devastating disasters in Puerto Rican history. And today, right?
Still, As we speak,
about 90% of the island is still without electricity. About half of the island is still without access to water. Things are improving and getting better, and Puerto Rico is a very resilient community.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but isn't that because they don't have the appropriate amount of political clout? They don't have two United States senators. They don't have a voting member of the House of Representatives. I mean, they are powerless when it comes to the political input that they have.
I mean, Puerto Rico has a resident commissioner that has a voice but no vote, and that's the extent of it, right? Puerto Ricans, if you are residing on the island of Puerto Rico, you can't vote for the president of the United States of America. If you're Puerto Rican on the mainland, you certainly can. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens by birth since 1917, but Puerto Ricans do not have that political clout, if you will, that other states in the union do have.
Let's go to the question of amoeba. I was a professor at your new institution for quite a while and thought highly of it. But I thought highly of my department, which was communication, and I really liked it. I thought it was great, but I didn't know anybody else there. Mm-hmm. And people say, do you know so-and-so in the sociology department, or do you know so-and-so in the history department? And the answer inevitably was no, mm-hmm. I don't know them. I think one of your most important tasks as the new 20th president, Dr. Rodriguez, is going to be to somehow form this amoeba into a functioning group of independent people who function as a unit.
You know, and one of the things, as you said very well, right, the university is a university, a research one university, recognized not only nationally but globally for the programs we offer, academic programs, for the research that we do, you know, an institution of great stature. And one of the things that I'm doing right now is going throughout the colleges and the schools and different units and having conversations about this, about, you know, who we are as a university, what is our identity as the university at Albany, what is it that we want to do and how we contribute to the greater good in terms of pushing the university forward, creating a greater university and serving our community. And indeed, part of it is getting people together to have these conversations about who we are, how we can collaborate. One of the things that I'm having a lot of discussions about is fostering cross-disciplinary and interdisciplinary collaborations, because of the very same thing that you indicated, right? So let's say in this case, as you know, we just recently established the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity, right? Very appropriate college, first of its kind in the country, will have significant impact given the events that are also happening. It's a college that's going to have important and significant contributions. But as a communications faculty member, think about the critical role that you can play with that college in sort of understanding how people receive information, perceive information, communicate information. As a sociologist or demographer, the role I can play there. As an engineer who looks at the development of radar technology, there's great interceptions there, right? As an atmospheric scientist who looks at evolving climate variability and focusing on the trajectory of severe events, right? Look at the intersections that can happen there. So one of my focuses, and I just met yesterday with the faculty members at the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences, I said, let's define topics or areas that we want to focus on, whether it's energy, whether it's climate change, whether it's disasters, whether it's, you know, socioeconomic mobility. And then let's think about the roles that different disciplines can play in helping us understand, study the impacts, consequences, and outcomes of these issues. That gets people together. That gets the folks in communication with the folks in sociology, with the folks in engineering and other colleges, having a conversation about the role we can play and how to get to know each other, and that we're part of the same community, we're part of the same university. So let's work together.
Now that, Dr. Rodriguez, that sounds great. However, I know a thing or two about faculty members mm-hmm. who are married to their disciplines and say, you're not us, you're not as good as we are. Mm-hmm. I'm a political scientist, so I don't think a communication person's good. Communication person say, oh, well, you know, we study all of these interactions you've just mentioned mm-hmm. so brilliantly, but that's different from what a historian does who's making up what the past may have done. How do you get over that?
Well, I think it's a matter of sitting down and having conversations. And let me tell you, for example, right, as a sociologist, demographer,
sure.
The majority of my research work in the area of disasters has been with engineers, with geographers, with people in the sciences, has been with political scientists, has been with a variety of other folks. When I was at the University of Delaware, we were having conversations with an art historian looking at the impacts of disasters and how do you preserve, right, relics and art and all that as a consequence of these major disasters that impact, whether man-made or not, human-made or not, that impact these individuals and these collections that we have. And so that's the work that I've personally been engaged all my life, working not only as an administrator, right, but as a researcher. My work has been interdisciplinary in nature. Most of my work has been funded not by the Social Science Directorate in the National Science Foundation, but by the Engineering Directorate in the National Science Foundation. So I think there's great opportunities. And so when you identify these issues all the way from public health to disasters and whatever you choose in between, there's a lot of opportunities for collaborations. The problem generally is that, you know, we build these institutions, right, and we build them around walls, right? They may be called colleges, and colleges are built around walls, maybe called departments, and sometimes we don't see past those walls. So my goal has always been, as a researcher and as an administrator, let's start knocking down those walls.
How do you do it?
And let's start having those conversations.
And one way to knock it down is, of course, joint appointments. You appoint somebody in sociology and politics, for example.
And so joint appointments are critical. At my former institution at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, as provost, I would get two deans together and we say, we're going to focus on this area. Let's hire some faculty members that have joint appointments. And I would say, you have 51% of the funding, you have 49% of the funding. If you get the faculty members, you get the funds. That's a joint appointment. If you don't get that faculty member, that's a joint appointment. I'm taking my money back. right? And so there's an economic incentive there as well, but there's an opportunity to work collaboratively and thinking about how is it that we can work across areas. And I think if you look at the University at Albany, you know, there's a high degree of interdisciplinary work that's already taking place at the university. So we've accomplished some great things there. So I think it's building on those successes, building on that strong foundation to continue to make this happen.
Yeah, I hesitate to bring this up, but, you know, there's been some problems at the university. You have the University at Albany. You have a sister institution, which Dr. Cagliaros was running. We have a wonderful chancellor who has left. We have your predecessor who has left. You know, you're going to have to pick up some pieces here. What do you make of all that?
Well, you know, I think the best thing to do is look at the past that has taken place at the university. Look at the challenges that we've confronted in the past, look at sort of the issues that have come up, and then thinking and building on those things and say, where and how do we build and how do we strengthen our institution, right? And so I look at the challenges and I look at the problems and I look at those experiences and say, how can we build to strengthen this university? How do we build and how do we look at the opportunities to continue to have a significant and important impact at our university? And so I know one of the concerns, right, is changes in leadership at the university, right? And so this is something that we're focusing on and we're working on to make sure we continue to strengthen and to make sure that we focus on the great opportunities that this university has to continue to move forward. So yes, let's look at the challenges of the past. Let's learn from them. Let's build on them to ensure the success of our institution in our communities. And you do that by continuing to build your leadership teams, by continuing to enhance the role of the institution within and outside this region and this community.
One of the critical decisions that was made, and you'll have to help me with my faulty historical memory here, was that we had Karen Hitchcock, who had been the president of the University of Albany for a while, objecting strenuously to pulling out this new college, new university, which basically shared the same grounds. Do you think that that was a fork in the road which should have been avoided?
Well, you know, I think that people make decisions at some point in time based on the data and based on the information that they have. And I think they make decisions that are in the best interest of the institution and of the community. And so that has
been done. No, you mean that they're making decisions based on what they think is the best, most rational way to go, but may not be.
That may be the case, right? We all make decisions and based on the information we have at a particular point in time.
Sure.
And we think that at that point in time, this is the best decision, right? 2 weeks down the road, a year down the road, we might get additional information and new data that would allow us to sort of rethink what we have done and whether there's a possibility of any changes. But as I look at it, right, we are part of the largest and perhaps the strongest university system in the country, the State University of New York, and we're working together and collaboratively, and Dr. Nancy Simfer did a marvelous job as the chancellor for this system. We now have a new chancellor, Dr. Christina Johnson, who is looking at how to continue to build and strengthen and expand this system that contributes so much to the region, to the state, nationally and globally. So I think we are in a good position to continue to have a significant and important impact in higher education, but in terms of being an economic engine for the state of New York and beyond, right? We are, for example, you look at UAlbany, we are one of the largest employers in the region, right? And we have an important economic impact. So I think that should be the focus. Let's move forward. Let's look at the opportunities. Let's build on the success. Let's build on the history of this great institution that has been around in different iterations since 1844. So we've got a long history and we've got a distinct history. We have great accomplishments. I was talking to a faculty member who retired after almost 30 years at the University at Albany. And so the transformation that this institution has experienced is remarkable,
it's
right?
It's unbelievable.
And the opportunities moving ahead are exciting. And there's challenges, but there's also great opportunities. And so my role as the president of the university, is to pull the communities together and continue to have these great conversations about how we enhance and strengthen the institution to continue to have success at the regional, the state, the national, and the global level.
Betsy DeVos, the education top honcho in the president's cabinet, has been sort of outspoken on the matter of sexuality and the way in which women have been denigrated. She takes a position which I do not share. And I'm wondering what you make of this newest round concerning sexual assault, which is apparently at an epidemic level, what your level of tolerance will be, as well as protecting the rights of the people who have been accused.
And I think that's a critically important question, right? And first and foremost, we're here to ensure the success of the students, but we're also here to ensure the safety of our students, right? And so we all have to work to develop a climate and an environment in which all people of all colors and backgrounds and beliefs feel welcomed and are welcome.
And are safe.
And that is a critical role that we play as an institution of higher education. And I can tell you for a fact that myself as president, my leadership team, and everybody else at the University of Albany, we take this very, very seriously, right? And so no matter what happens at any other level, this is going to be something that we focus on, that we ensure the safety of our students, that if any of these issues emerge at our institution, that we take a direct approach to it to really ensure that we are addressing the issues, we're addressing the issues in a timely manner, and that we're protecting our students.
And so how does it work, Dr. Rodriguez? Somebody comes into you or somebody comes into your team and says, I was sexually attacked. What do you do?
Well, we have a very detailed and elaborate process and offices and personnel that deal with these issues. And so we report these to our Title IX officer, depending on the type of situation, the police may be involved or not. And then there's an entire process. There's an investigative process as well. So the goal here is to protect the potential folks that have been impacted by these types of events, but take a comprehensive look. We don't want to take any irrational decisions. We want to make decisions, but while at the same time, right, safety and the protection of our students is at the forefront. And so we're going to follow our processes as a state institution. You know, the governor and the state has clear policies in this regard as well, which the university implements. And so I believe that we have strong and robust processes in place to ensure that we address these issues in a timely manner and ensuring that everybody is heard and that we continue to ensure that our students are in an environment where they feel safe.
Have you been tested yet on this in your short time here?
Well, you know, there's always issues that emerge at an institution of higher education. And so, you know, we look at them as they emerge. But, you know, it's an issue that, as you said before, if you look at the national media, unfortunately, it's an issue that, you know, all of us as leaders of institutions of higher education, we have to address. But it's not only in institutions of higher education, right? You know, universities are a microcosm of societies at large, right? And so what happens in society at large also happens in institutions of higher education. We just have to be vigilant. We have to ensure that we address these issues in a timely manner, and we ensure that our students, our faculty, and our staff feel that they work in a safe environment where administrators and others will watch out for their safety as well.
We're talking to Dr. Havidan Rodriguez, the president of the University of Albany. Dr. Rodriguez, first of all, thank you again for being here with us. The president of the United States is pulling the purse strings these days, and it looks like you may find, a crisis in how much money you have to work with.
Well, you know, budgets for institutions of higher education are always something that we focus on in terms of how we continue to generate the funding to support our institutions. And there's a variety of fundings that we receive, right? I mean, we receive federal funds, we receive state funds, and Governor Cuomo has been incredibly supportive of initiatives that have taken place at the University at Albany. And so we thank the state for their strong support and commitment to higher education. You know, students also pay tuition. We want to pay careful attention to access so that income is not a factor that keeps students out of the university. universities. So providing scholarships and fellowships and things of that nature are going to be critical for our students. Our university also depends on external research expenditures. So making sure that we continue to develop projects of excellence that generate funding through the university, through foundations, National Science Foundation, NOAA, National Institutes of Health is also critical. And another leg of funding is philanthropy. So endowments, gifts, and things of that nature from private individuals, corporations, and foundations. So the funding sources for the university are multiple. And so we can't exclusively depend on one leg or the other. We need to look at this holistically and work very hard so as, you know, funding from this area may diminish, we focus on increasing funding from another area. So indeed, as you very well know, the budget models for our universities are very complex. And so we have many mechanisms in place to ensure that we continue to get federal funding, we continue to get state funding, we continue to generate the tuition dollars, and we continue to get funding through research and philanthropy.
But as a disaster preparedness guy, you've got to be looking around the corner to say, wait a second now, what happens if we lose just a part of that? You just mentioned federal funding. Do we have to have some kind of plan for where we go?
That's right. And I think looking at budgets at the university level, at this holistic level, as I just mentioned to you, it's critically important because you know that you have to continue to build in several areas to ensure that the funding continues to come in. If A disappears, you've got to have a plan, right? You've got to have a plan to generate additional resources. So, you know, we have a great team. We're having those discussions since I got here on a regular basis about funding for the institution, areas that we need to focus on, folks that we need to continue to engage at the university level. You know, fortunately for the university at Albany, we've got strong support from the community as well. And so we have significant donors to our institutions. Some are alumni, many are not alumni, right? Because they strongly support and value the role that UAlbany plays in this city, in this region, and in this state. And so we've got strong support at that level. But we're always having to focus on different revenues of resources for our institution just to make sure that we're continuing to grow because we have to grow as an institution of higher education.
And the what ifs. I mean, I know at this radio station where we're speaking at now, I'm always thinking about what if. What if they stop giving money to public radio, even the little bit that they give? What will we do How we make that up? Sometimes those things happen in the middle of the night for me. Do you have those middle of the night thoughts too?
I have a lot of middle of the night thoughts, right? But I think, again, thinking about my perspective as someone who does research on disasters,
sure.
You know, a lot of people focus on the response, right? And you invest billions of dollars in responding to these events, right? And if you spend maybe 10% of that money in the area of mitigation, right?
Or
in terms of
preparedness,
Then you would alleviate some of the consequences of these events. And so that's what we also have to do in institutions of higher education. We have to mitigate, we have to prepare, and make sure that we are well prepared to deal with these types of issues that emerge on a daily basis for us.
I've often thought about alumni. You know, you got a Williams, you got a Harvard, you got a Yale. You know, it's a culture of giving.
Yes.
You know, you get out, you give money, and they have billions of dollars. Institutions like SUNY, you get a telephone call. Somebody, an alumni, gets a telephone call and says, can you give us some money? It takes a whole different thought process. There's a question there somewhere.
So the answer to that is, fortunately for us, we have a phenomenal advancement office, development advancement. And we have a strong team there that has worked very hard with alumni in the city, in the region, in the state, across the country, and literally across the world, right? Making and strengthening those bonds, right? Ensuring that people know the value of this education and how they can contribute and how they can give back for the education that they receive.
Are we making any progress, Doctor? In other words, are we making any progress in terms of a culture shift that, hey, you took something out, now you should put something back in?
Yeah. And I think we are, right? But the greatest culture change has to start in that, you know, you don't build that culture when people graduate from the university. You start building that culture when students start coming in the door.
Interesting.
As a first-year student, right? As a second-year student.
And how do you do that?
You have a terrible experience, you know, as an undergraduate student or as a master's and PhD student. You don't want to think about those experiences again, right? And so that impacts what you give back to the university. And how do you address that? You address that by providing an excellent education, by providing great services to our students. You help in that regard by providing student engagement and experiential learnings, study abroad, research, service learning, internships, right? You develop this culture of, I am part of this university. I belong here. You develop those mentoring relationships with your faculty and with your staff. So it's a process you begin to build. You begin to build this donor base as soon as that's to actually, even before, as you start recruiting these students, when they walk in your door, they become potential donors, right? But also remember, right, that some of our greatest donors as well are not alumni. And so there's people out there, business individuals, representatives from government agencies, foundations, that are strong donors and supporters of this university. And so our base, right, also involves our community and our region and beyond. So we have to work collectively and collaboratively with those individuals so that they know that we are an integral part of the community. We're not an ivory tower, and we want to become an anchor institution for this great city and great state of New York.
I want to talk to you a little bit about politicians. You have to depend on politicians, no question about it. I know an awful lot of college presidents. I've interviewed almost everybody in our region at one point or another. I always ask them this question. In your career, has a politician ever showed up in your office and said, do this or else?
In my career, the answer is no. And I've been in many leadership positions, as you know. When I was in Texas, in the creation of the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, which you just explained, this had to be approved by the legislature and this in the state and the governor. And so this was a mandate to create a new university and a brand new school of medicine. And yes, we had engaged what we call our Valley delegation, the legislators from the Rio Grande Valley, to go en masse and support this, you know, as one team and one group. And when this got approved at the state legislature, it was a unanimous vote, right? I mean, how could you oppose such a great project? And so my role has been as interim president, as former provost, and now as president here at UAlbany to work with our legislators, to work with our senators, to work with our congresspeople, to continue to support higher education. And we've got people who are strongly committed to higher education that have put their entire support on the SUNY system, the CUNY system, and other institutions of higher education.
Okay.
Because it's in the best interest of the region and the state.
Got it. Now, it is not unknown that a college president has a legislator, a state senator, assemblyman, congressman show up at his office and say, I have a nephew, dot, dot, dot. And you could fill in the blanks after that. Or, I don't like what this professor, tenured professor who works for you, is saying about my party or about me. Fire him. I want you to fire him. Now, what do you do then?
Well, you know, I think we have processes in place for a variety of these issues that you have highlighted, right? If someone wants to be employed at the university and there's an open position, there's a process for people to apply for these positions and then follow the process so that we have equitable and fair processes for these positions that are open, right? And, you know, we have all discourse about issues that come up in institutions of higher education or what faculty say or don't say, what students say or don't say, right? We live in institutions of higher education about promoting knowledge, and it's about promoting diversity, and it's about promoting differences of opinion. And I think that is what makes institutions of higher education great, that we can have those conversations, we can have those engaging conversations, and we can agree to disagree on a variety of topics. But I have to respect your right, right, unless it impacts the safety of any individuals on the campus, right? We've got a straight process in how we deal with those situations, but people who have an opportunity to express themselves freely at our institutions. And I have to be respectful and mindful of your thoughts and ideas, and you have to be mine.
Yeah, but...
Right? So...
Isn't there, Dr. Rodriguez, isn't there a matter of backbone? I mean, at some point, somebody comes and asks you to do something you think is unethical. And you know, as many Republican senators in the United States Senate are thinking now, if you deviate from the norm that is expected of you, you're out. We see it all the time. And I've seen college presidents risk all, and at least in one case, face all, as a result of having said, no, I'm not firing that guy, in this case me, because that's not what tenure is supposed to be guaranteeing. And at that point, you know, you've got a tough decision to make.
Well, let me couch it in this way. There's three words that I value and that I live with on a daily basis and that I've lived with throughout my professional and personal career. And they are honesty, integrity, and being ethical and moral in everything that I do. And so if a decision does not meet those standards, I will make the corresponding decision. So, you know, I have to be honest. I have to show a high degree of integrity. And I have to make decisions that I can ethically and morally support as a president of an institution of higher education, or as a faculty member, or as a provost, or as a human being, right? And so that is my philosophy. And when, you know, I won't speculate on what I'll do in X or Y situation, but when those situations come to me, you know what compass I use to make my decisions.
Well, I have great respect for that, except that you've been around for a while. You've been a provost for a while. You say that it has never come up before. Is that right? I mean, it has never come up that somebody's walked into your office and said, I want that professor gone.
That is absolutely correct. It has never occurred in my personal and professional career. It has never occurred to me. And, you know, and I've occupied many, many positions, right? It's starting as associate director of a department to chair, to associate dean, to dean of academic affairs, to deputy provost, vice provost, provost, and now president. And so I haven't experienced that situation. Doesn't mean I will not. But, you know, what I've made clear to you today in terms of my moral compass is something that I've always made very clear to everybody else as well.
And when they hired you in your interview, you said this to them?
I wasn't asked that particular question, but people very well knew what my stance was in terms of my leadership philosophy, which they, of course, ask about. They ask about my decision-making processes. They ask about, you know, how these decisions are made and how do I engage individuals. And so I think the committee that made a recommendation was very clear in terms of my overall philosophy about decision-making.
Now, Dr. Rodriguez, you have to protect yourself. I have no doubt about that. Everybody in a leadership position does. And I love the fact that you've just reiterated what those three moral compasses look like. But you also have to learn from those around you, from those at other institutions who didn't act quickly enough when a sexual predator was discovered or something like that. So your learning curve is obvious that you're at the top now, and you must be learning something from what you read in the papers.
You learn a lot of things from experience. You learn a lot of things from what happens across the country and what happens across the street, right? So my responsibility is to look at that information, digest that information, think about what we would do in similar situations. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not about me, right? It's not about Abidan Rodriguez. It's really about the presidency. And so my role is to protect the presidency, right? Our role is to protect our institution. It's not about a single individual, right? It's not what I am going to do for the University at Albany. It's what we're going to do for the University at Albany, right? I look at this as a collective process in which communication, engagement, active participation. And I think if something I've shown during the first month, you know, I, as president of the university, will take the leadership position that has been entrusted in me, but that this is a collective process. So when people ask me, so what are you going to do for the university? My response is, you're asking the wrong question. The question is, what are we going to do for the university? I think you would agree that it's not my university, it's our university. You are faculty at UAlbany for many, many years. So you've got great interests, great passion, a great investment of your time, of your life at that university. So you should be as vested as I am to ensure that the presidency, not Abidan Rodriguez, the presidency is successful and that UAlbany is successful. And this has sort of been my guiding light throughout time. It's not about me. It's about us. It's about the institution.
We're out of time. We've been talking to Dr. Abidan Rodriguez, the president of the University of Albany. Dr. Rodriguez, I am incredibly honored and happy with your answers and what you've said here today. You're obviously a very important cog in the machinery, the academic machinery of this state and of this nation. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure joining you.
I'm Alan Chartow.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.